Good evening, my friends, and welcome back to Hitchens on Horror. I am your host, Josh Hitchens, and tonight we're doing a deep dive into Friday the 13th, the final chapter. Or is it? All right, my friends, welcome back to our exploration of the first 8 Friday the 13th movies, the ones that were made during the decade of the 1980s, the prime decade for the slasher film. I apologize, this episode is coming to you a day late. I try and release all these episodes on Fridays, of course, but I was, to be honest, preoccupied with the season 5 finale of The Last Drive-In with Joe Bob Briggs on Shudder. It will not happen again. I'll make sure to get all these episodes out on a Friday for you so we can enjoy them on the weekend. So as we talked about last week, Friday the 13th Part 3 was intended to be the last film of a trilogy of Friday the 13th films. But it did not end up being the last movie. The producer, Frank Mancuso Jr., wanted to do one final movie to bring the franchise to a close in a really effective way. Because Frank Mancuso Jr., even though the Friday the 13th movies, you know, were made for very little money and made a tremendous amount of money at the box office, Mancuso felt that he was not being respected as a producer, was not being taken seriously because the Friday the 13th movies were considered to be trash. And maybe they are, but they're glorious, really fun trash. So he decided to move on with his career, do one final movie to kill Jason off once and for all. The slogan for this movie was, "Jason is back, and this is the one you've been screaming for." They also used the slogan, "This is Jason's unlucky day." For Friday the 13th, the final chapter, brought back amazing special effects horror makeup gore wizard Tom Savini, who, of course, did the makeup for the first Friday the 13th film. And Tom Savini was really interested to be brought back for the final chapter because he had, in effect, created the character of Jason visually, even though he appears as a child at the end of the first Friday the 13th in a dream sequence. But he wanted to be able to kill the monster he had helped create. He said he felt like Frankenstein. He brought this monster to life, and now he gets to kill him. And Tom Savini being back as the makeup guy on Friday the 13th, the final chapter, is one of many things that I think really elevates this movie to a whole new level. Friday the 13th, the final chapter, takes place one day after Part 3 ends. So it's interesting, and this won't happen again in the series, but it's interesting that Friday the 13th, Part 2, Part 3, and the final chapter are all one long sequence that take place over just a couple of days, during which time Jason Voorhees kills 34 people. Very impressive for, you know, less than a week, he kills 34 people. There was no Friday the 13th movie in 1983. You know, the first movie came out in 1980, Part 2, 1981, Part 3, 1982. No movie in 1983. Friday the 13th, the final chapter, effectively Part 4, came out in 1984, which means that we have finally caught up to the real-world timeline, because as we've talked about, the timeline of these movies gets a little wonky. First movie takes place in 1970, but Part 2 takes place mostly 5 years later, which means it is set in 1984. So both Part 2 and Part 3 take place in the future. But now that we're in 1984, in the real world, the Friday the 13th franchise has caught up to real time. for the director of this film. The producers really wanted Joseph Zito to direct the final chapter. Joseph Zito, at this time, was primarily known as the director of the slasher movie The Prowler, which came out in 1981, which, if you have not seen The Prowler, I highly recommend it. Really, really terrific example of the slasher genre in the early 1980s. Very unique and very effective, very nasty film. The kills in those in that film are brutal. Also, special effects makeup in that movie by Tom Savini, which might have something to do with it. The Prowler is supposed to be set in Avalon, California, but was actually filmed in Cape May, New Jersey, which is a lovely beach town. Still has a lot of Victorian buildings and influence. And I think filming The Prowler in Cape May, New Jersey, really, and because of Joseph Zito's brilliance as a director, really lends The Prowler, even amongst its viciousness, there's almost like a dreamlike, weird, mystical quality to it. Highly, highly recommend The Prowler. If you haven't seen it, check it out. If you have Shudder, Joe Bob did it on the last drive-in during the original marathon. Highly recommend checking out what he has to say about it. When they hired Joseph Zito as director, they also wanted him to write the script for Friday the 13th, the final chapter, as well. And Joseph Zito said to them, I'm not a writer. They offered him double the money, offered him director salary and the same salary to write the screenplay. And Joseph Zito said, okay, I'm a writer. Joseph Zito didn't write the screenplay, though. He used the portion of the money that he was being paid to do that to pay a screenwriter named Barney Cohen to write the script for the final chapter. And the way they went about writing the script was pretty funny because the studio thought that Joseph Zito was writing it and only found out much later on that he did not, sort of went rogue and hired his own screenwriter. So what would happen is that Joseph Zito would have these phone calls every night during the pre-production process with Phil Scuderi, who's one of the investors in the Friday the 13th franchise, been there since the beginning, had a lot of creative input into it. Phil Scuderi and Joseph Zito would talk. Then Joseph Zito would talk to Barney Cohen about the ideas that he and Phil Scuderi had come up with, and Barney Cohen would translate that into pages of a script. And then Joseph Zito would bring those pages of script back to Phil Scuderi and the other producers, and that's how the script got written, which is really fun. And it's a really, really good script, this film. This film is also notable because I think it has, I would say, probably the best cast of actors of any Friday the 13th movie. And I'm going to talk about them before we get started with the film. Let's start with Jason, since that is the order of the day. We're killing Jason for real and for true in this movie. The actor they cast as Jason for this film was Ted White, who's the oldest person to ever play Jason. He was 58 years old at the time he made Friday the 13th, the final chapter. And he was a very, very experienced, highly respected stuntman and actor. For instance, was a double in movies for people like John Wayne and Clark Gable, many other Hollywood stars of that golden age. And originally, when Ted White was offered Friday the 13th, the final chapter, he turned it down. But they really wanted him. They offered the role to him again. And finally, he said yes, because he needed the money. Then he went and he rented the previous Friday the 13th movies from the video store. And he decided he wanted to do something different with the role of Jason Voorhees. In the previous films, Ted White felt that Jason kind of was lumbering, moved very, very slow. He was clumsy. So Ted White wanted to switch it up a little bit. He wanted to do something different. He wanted to make Jason faster, make the kills be more efficient and more brutal, since this was the very last they were going to see of Jason. Ted White was two or three times older than anyone else on the movie, and really didn't get along with many people on this film. Butted heads with director Joseph Zito about several things, including the treatment of some of the female actors in this movie, which good for him for sticking up for them. We'll talk more about those incidents a little bit later on. Did not think much of the film, even though he gave it his all. Didn't really think it was a very good movie, and he asked that he not be credited in the film. So the name Ted White does not appear in the credits in the final chapter, but he is our Jason. And a lot of people consider Ted White to be one of the best Jasons of the franchise. Producers certainly thought so. When they decided to make more movies, they offered Ted White the role of Jason in Part 5. He said no. They offered him the role of Jason in the 6th movie. He said no. And later on, he said he regretted that decision, wished he'd done it, but he didn't. One actor that Ted White definitely did not get along with and has been very, very vocal about it in interviews and various documentaries is that he hated Corey Feldman. Ted White thought that Corey Feldman was the meanest little kid he'd ever worked with, found him very annoying. But in spite of all that, he did think that Corey Feldman was a very good actor in the film, really respected his work as a performer. And that brings us to our next cast member, Corey Feldman, as Tommy Jarvis, a character who will become very important in the Friday the 13th mythos as it goes on. Corey Feldman was 12 years old when he made this movie. And his character was named Tommy, in homage to Tom Savini. And you can really see that in Tommy's character because he is making all these horror masks and effects and things like that. Now, this 1984 was a really great year for the career of young Corey Feldman. It's really the year that he, you know, really broke out into the mainstream as an actor. Same year, Friday 13th Final Chapter came out. A few months later, Gremlins comes out, just 2 months after Friday 13th, the Final Chapter does. And he has a great, really fun, memorable role in Gremlins as well. Then in 1985, Corey Feldman made The Goonies. A year later, 1986, he made Stand By Me, great Stephen King adaptation, one of the very, very best Stephen King adaptations. And then in 1987, played one of the Frog brothers in The Lost Boys alongside Corey Haim. And of course, they became known as the two Coreys, became hugely famous and successful for a while. One thing I did not know until I started doing research for this episode is that Corey Feldman also was the voice of Donatello in the original Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles live-action movie in 1990, reprised that role in the third Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie, 1993, and also was in Tales from the Crypt, Bordello of Blood in 1996. So Corey Feldman really has a wonderful place in horror history throughout his career. Of course, as many people know, Corey Feldman, along with his best friend Corey Haim, struggled with drug addiction and trauma due to abuse they received as children. And Corey Haim is no longer with us. He lost his battle with addiction. But Corey Feldman has really been vocal about child sexual abuse in Hollywood, which was rampant then and is still rampant now. Is very, very brave for speaking out about that. Corey Feldman's also really embraced his role in the Friday the 13th family. He is actually the narrator of the great Crystal Lake Memories documentary, which I highly recommend you watch if we haven't. Playing Tommy Jarvis's older sister is Kimberly Beck as Trish Jarvis. Kimberly Beck is very notable because she is the only Friday the 13th actor to have also appeared in an Alfred Hitchcock movie. Kimberly Beck played the young version of Tippi Hedren's character in Alfred Hitchcock's Marnie. Kimberly Beck also is in the movie Massacre at Central High in 1976, which sounds fun. She had a bit role as a housewife in Independence Day in 1996, eventually did retire from acting. Kimberly Beck also had some unnerving encounters while filming Friday the 13th, the final chapter. She said that when she would be out jogging or running, she would see a man watching her from his car. She would get these strange, mysterious phone calls, hang-up phone calls, or heavy breathing, which really freaked her out. But once filming of the movie was over, all of it stopped. The stalking stopped. So echoes of Adrienne King, who played Alice in Friday the 13th, the first one and the second one, who also dealt with a stalker. It's interesting that it all stopped once filming ended. So, you know, it makes you think maybe it was someone in the cast or crew who's doing it. Maybe seriously, maybe as a joke. We don't know. But Kimberly Beck, I'm glad you're safe. Also, we have as their mother, Mrs. Jarvis, Joan Freeman. She was a veteran actor of both television and film. Appeared with Vincent Price in the movie The Tower of London in 1962. In 1964, she was Elvis Presley's love interest in the movie Roustabout. Friday the 13th, the final chapter, was her final film role, though. Now, moving on to our cast of teenagers. And it's a really interesting thing about this movie, and one of the things I think that makes the final chapter a richer movie, is that so you have the family that I just talked about, this single mother with her teenage daughter, 12-year-old son. They're living in a house. And next to them, this group of, you know, horny partying teenagers moves in. So it's an interesting dichotomy that brings up, that it's not the same old as the first three movies. You're not just going to get watch a bunch of teenagers get killed in interesting ways. You also have this family dynamic as well, and you have a child involved, which just gives the final chapter something a little bit extra. But getting to the teenagers, Joseph Sito really wanted the teen characters to feel more real than they had in previous installments, so that you got to know them and so that you cared about them when they died. And I really think they succeeded in that. So going through our teen cast here, we have Eric Anderson as Rob Dyer, fun name. And the character of Rob in this movie is meant to be the brother of the character Sandra, who was killed in Friday the 13th Part 2 as one of the two people who got a spear poked through both their bodies when they were having sex. Sandra's played by Marta Kober in Part 2. And keep in mind that even though this movie is made years and years later, that Part 2 in the movie timeline was just a couple days ago. So just a few days later, Sandra's brother Rob has come to Camp Crystal Lake or its vicinity to hunt Jason, or the bear, as he calls him in an early scene. We have Lawrence Monoson as Ted, who's a funny character. And the franchise of Friday the 13th is kind of notorious for recycling names as the series goes on. You might remember, in the first movie, we have a character named Ned. Then in Part 2, there's a character named Ted, who's also the funny character. That character becomes Shelley in Part 3. But now, again, in the fourth movie, the final chapter, we have another Ted. Funny. Lawrence Monoson was one of the more famous actors at the time appearing in this movie. He played the lead in the 1982 movie The Last American Virgin, which was a big hit. We also have Peter Barton as Doug. Peter Barton was also kind of a name at the time the final chapter was made and released. He played the lead character in a TV series called The Powers of Matthew Starr, where one of his co-stars was actually Amy Steele, who had played Ginny in Friday the 13th Part 2. We love Amy Steele. And for that role in that TV series, Peter Barton, for that role, beat out an actor by the name of Tom Cruise. And you can see why Peter Barton is very, very, very unnaturally handsome. And It was interesting how he came to do this movie. Peter Barton had previously starred in a 1981 slasher movie called Hell Night, co-starring with Linda Blair. I love Hell Night. Another recommendation. If you've never seen it, give it a watch. It's really, really fun. But Peter Barton did not want to do Hell Night. He went on the record and said that the producers actually had to get him drunk to make him agree to do the part. And he did the part, and he didn't enjoy the experience of being in a horror movie at all. And he was offered a role in Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter. Again, like, did not want to do it. But then his co-star from the TV show, Amy Steele, aka Ginny from Part 2, talked him into it, convinced him to do the film. And Peter Barton finally came around and said, yeah, you know, this will be very cool. Like, these movies are so famous, and I'm going to be in the very last one. And then he later said, little did I know. But he's great in this movie. Peter Barton later went on to be primarily an actor in television soap operas, a genre I love, love, love. He was in many years on The Young and the Restless. He was on Sunset Beach, and Playgirl once voted him one of the 10 sexiest guys in soaps. I agree. We also have Barbara Howard as Sarah, who, like Amy Steele, eventually left acting to become a therapist. Barbara Howard refused to do the nudity that was written for the character of Sarah in the script. They tried to convince her. She said, no, absolutely not. I'm not doing it. Good for her. So they hired a nude double for her named Robin Wood. We have Jodie Aronson as Samantha, who is also in another very famous 1980s movie, Weird Science, released in 1985. And Jodie Aronson has said that prior to being cast in Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, she was actually cast in a movie that had Academy Award buzz about it, in a lead role. She's never said what that movie was. I would love to know what it was. But she was eventually fired from that movie because they wanted her to pretend that she was Hispanic. And Jodie Aronson is not Hispanic. She refused to do that, quite rightly. So she was fired from the movie and was offered the role in Friday the 13th, Final Chapter, and she took it. Also in this movie, we have twins, identical twin sisters, Camilla and Carrie Moore, who were very, very often cast together in films and on television shows. They have a joint Wikipedia page, which is a little weird. Camilla is actually the one who auditioned for Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter. She auditioned for the role of Samantha, which later went to Jodie Aronson. But she was very nervous about, the nudity in the script. And the casting director, while she was doing her audition, noticed on her resume that she said she had an identical twin sister. And the casting director said if her twin sister Carrie agreed to do the movie, both of them would be cast in the movie. And that is what happened. Again, in the script for the twins, there was nudity required for both of them. And Camilla was very, very nervous about it. But Carrie, she said, had always been the more adventurous one, the brave one. And Carrie was all in, like, yeah, I'll do the nudity. So Camilla said that if it wasn't for her sister Carrie encouraging her and being there and supporting her with that nude scene in front of this all of the male crew, she probably wouldn't have done the movie. Oh, God. And it really, again, it's an embarrassment of riches in this cast. We've got Crispin Glover, the great, weird, crazy genius Crispin Glover as Jimmy in this movie. He was in Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter, a year before he blew up in 1985's Back to the Future as George McFly. He's so, so good. I'm going to be just singing his praises all throughout this process. We also have Alan Hayes as Paul. Again, we have another Ted. We've got another Paul. There was a Paul in Part 2 as well. Now we've got another one. Not a lot of information out there about Alan Hayes as an actor, but he is here. He is present in The Final Chapter. Now, like Part 2 and Part 3, Friday 13th, The final chapter is filmed in Southern California, in three different locations, one of which was Topanga Canyon. The house that they used as the Jarvis, as the house where the Jarvis family lives, was a real house. It is actually still standing to this day. The director, producers just fell in love with this house. It was in the perfect location in the woods. They needed to build the other house, you know, next door to it, where all the teenagers come to spend their time. So that house was actually built from scratch, but the Jarvis house is real. They started filming Friday the 13th, the final chapter, on Halloween, on October 31st, 1983. And the cast actually took little Corey Feldman out trick-or-treating at the end of filming, and they said it was surreal because as they were trick-or-treating, they saw all these kids in Jason Voorhees costumes, and here they were, unbeknownst to any one of them, making the next and final Friday the 13th movie. They filmed all throughout the winter. It was a very long filming process, actually. So it started on Halloween 1983. They didn't finish filming the movie until January 1984. So again, this is filmed in the middle of winter, which was a problem a lot of the time, which I'm going to be talking about as we go. The movie was originally planned to be released in October 1984. But Frank Mancuso Jr. Loved the footage so much that he decided to move up the release date of the movie significantly. Instead of being released in October 1984, he moved it to April 1984. So it actually was going to open on Friday, April 13th, which meant that director Joseph Seto and the production team only had 6 weeks to complete the editing and post-production on this film. So to ensure that they did, Paramount Pictures actually rented a house for the director and the editors to stay in, basically kept them prisoner there, locked them in so they couldn't leave, brought them all of their meals so that they would finish the movie on time. And they did. And it's a great one. All right, let's do our body count, my friends. We have 14 murders in this movie. Some of the methods of murder are hacksaw to the throat, scalpel gutting, knife through various parts of various bodies, spear to the groin and the back, corkscrew through the hand, followed by cleaver to the face, thrown through window. There's a lot of window throwing in this film. Head crushing, axe to the chest, garden tool to the throat, machete to the head and eye. Now, I've been rating these movies in terms of machetes. I give Friday the 13th, the final chapter, 4 machetes. I gave the first movie 4 machetes as well. I gave this and the fourth movie also 4 machetes. And there is one more in this franchise that I think is the third undisputably great Friday the 13th film. You can start guessing about which one that is. We'll get to it. All right, folks, I hope you got your popcorn ready. We're going to start this movie now. You're going to watch along with me, and we'll take breaks along the way to talk about what's going on and the history behind it. Now, you are going to start the movie, and you're going to pause once you reach 25 minutes and 20 seconds. See you in 25 minutes and 20 seconds, my friends. Enjoy. Previously on Friday the 13th. I love that this film again gives you, you know, flashbacks to what has happened, not only in part 2 and part 3, but also part 1 as well. So again, knowing that this is the very last Friday the 13th movie, we're going to embrace all the history, show you the best kills from all 3 previous movies, and of course anchoring it with that great monologue, Paul's campfire story from part 2. And I love the opening credits where you have Jason's hockey mask coming out with the title Friday 13th on it. And then Jason's mask just explodes in a giant ball of fire. you just know that you're going to have a good time watching this movie as soon as you see that. It's so ridiculous and over the top, and I love it. This movie is the only movie to use sets and location from a previous film, because again, Final Chapter is picking up pretty much right after Part 3 ends, so they went back to the location and the buildings they used for Part 3, and it's such a great opening scene. You know, it starts with, you know, the searchlight helicopters above on the crime scene at night. You have tons of police cars and ambulances, these, you know, the red and blue lights and the sirens amidst this dark, dark forest. It looks expensive and epic. Again, great opening to the film. And it looks expensive, even though this film was not. They made it for a pretty comparable budget to the first three. They made it for $2.2 million. But I think it's the difference with a truly great director, which I think Joseph Zito is. Certainly the best director that the franchise has seen so far. As much as I really enjoy Steve Miner's work in Part 2 and Part 3, and I like Sean Cunningham in Part 1 as well, but Joseph Zito just brings the Final Chapter up to a new level in terms of technical filmmaking. I think the movie just looks better and more professional than the other films so far. And we take, of course, Jason's corpse, or what they think is Jason's corpse, to a hospital where we meet two delightful characters. We have Bruce Mahler as the wonderfully named character of Axel Bums, the hilariously funny morgue attendant who is just shoving food in his face while over a corpse as he's talking to the police. Bruce Mahler is most well known for appearing in, I think, if I remember correctly, four of the Police Academy movies. And he is also known for playing the character of Elaine's rabbi friend in several episodes of Seinfeld, including the very last episode. So that might be where he's familiar to a lot of folks. And you also have Lisa Freeman as Nurse Robbie Morgan, which is a lovely Easter egg, of which there's several in this movie, sort of Easter eggs about films that have come before. But the Nurse Robbie Morgan is a tribute to the actor Robbie Morgan, who played the character Annie in the first Friday the 13th movie. And if you might remember, Annie is the very first character to be killed by Mrs. Voorhees in the present day timeline of the first film. And interestingly, Lisa Freeman is also in Back to the Future, Parts 1 and 2, as is Crispin Glover, who's also in this film as well. And there's a really fun thing it's very subtle, you might miss it, but there's a shot of Jason in the cold morgue where you see his breath, like the fog of his breath, very, very subtly for a moment. A wonderful clue that Jason Voorhees is not really dead. And we come back to Axel, who is really trying to get with Nurse Robbie, and he's gearing up for hooking up with her by watching the very popular Aerobicize videos, which are very popular in the 1980s. And the one they're watching stars, or features, I should say, Darcy DeMoss, who actually would go on to be an actor in the sixth Friday the 13th movie, which is a fun little bit of trivia for you. There, love the relationship and the back and forth between Axel and Nurse Robbie. They have really fun lines, really fun chemistry. You know, I love, she says, you are the Super Bowl of self-abuse. And, you know, when he gets startled, Axel says, jumping Jesus, Christmas shit, and various variations on that. They're just a really great double act comedy team, these two. And when Axel's killed, again, really great directing by Joseph Zito. I love that interspersed with him, with Axel being killed. It's interspersed with the women from the Aerobicize videos looking out from the TV as if they're watching and seeing him die and kind of enjoying it. And then Nurse Robbie gets killed as well, very sadly. And then it's no time to mourn. These two hapless hospital/morgue employees. We're right onto our new cast, starting with the Jarvis family. Love that Mrs. Jarvis tells Tommy while he's wearing like the alien-esque mask, like, get a haircut. And that's a bit of foreshadowing for later in the movie. Remember that. And we start meeting the teenagers as well. Wonderful scene between Crispin Glover's character and the character of Ted in the car was largely improvised by both of them. You know, the whole thing of like, you're a dead fuck. I'm a dead fuck. Oh God, I'm horny. It's really funny, really endearing. And again, they made that up. And as they're driving along, they pass by the grave of Mrs. Voorhees. And it is in this movie, the fourth movie, where we learn for the first time that Mrs. Voorhees' first name is Pamela, because it says so on her gravestone. And Betsy Palmer, who played Mrs. Voorhees, said, she's like, oh, I found out my name was Pamela like 10, 15 years later. I didn't know that. And on the gravestone, it says, you know, Pamela Voorhees, 1930 to 1979, at rest. And I have to wonder, like, is she buried with her severed head? Because last time we saw it was on Jason's altar. So is the head there too? Or is it just the body without the head? And also, what is she doing just being buried in a random grave by the side of the road? Who knows? Because the script says so. But it's fun. We have another character who is introduced pretty much to get slaughtered, but it's a really memorable cameo by Bonnie Hellman, who is credited as Hitchhiker, but in the original script, the character was originally called Blubbery Girl, which is gross, and I'm glad they changed that to just Hitchhiker. Sad they couldn't actually give her a name, but she's really, really funny. You know, she is holding up a sign as the car approaches that says peace and love on it, and the teen guys are like, hey, you got a sister? And she turns the sign around, it says fuck you on it, and she gives him the finger. It's great. And then she's eating a banana, and then Jason Voorhees comes up behind her and puts a knife through her throat. And it's not actually Ted White killing the Hitchhiker character. It is actually Tom Savini doing that. And as they were setting up for it, Bonnie Hellman said that Tom Savini told her, like, exactly what would really happen to you if you were getting a knife put through your throat, you know, what that would do to your voice box and things like that. And he said, you're going to be just fine. Just don't fight me. Just let me do the work. And I love the close-up of, like, her hand squishing the banana out. Really effective way of, without showing, like, the gore, of showing the horrific nature of the pain she's in as she is dying. Love Bonnie Hellman as the Hitchhiker. Great, great, great. When she was offered the role, her agent said, oh, you're not going to want to do this. You don't have any lines. But Bonnie Hellman did it anyway and still appears at horror conventions to this day. We love her. We got another pet in Friday the 13th, the final chapter. We have Gordon the dog. And the dog is named Gordon because Joseph Zito, the director, had a close friend of his who had a dog named Gordon who had recently died. And so Joseph Zito named the dog Gordon in this film as well. And I have to agree, you know, because like I said, what Joseph Zito wanted was he wanted the teen characters especially to feel real, that you liked them and got to know them. And I really think he succeeded in that. We get to spend some time with all of them. They're all pretty good company. I really do think it's the best overall job at characterization since the first film, maybe even better than the first film. I love when Corey Feldman is seeing one of the teen girl characters getting undressed outside his window because the houses are so close. I think it's so adorable just how excited he is, like screaming into his pillow with joy and like jumping up on the bed and kicking his feet. It again, I think it's really wonderful tribute both to the script and the acting of Corey Feldman, because like it feels so authentic. Like that feels like if I was a 12-year-old boy who really wanted to see boobs, that's probably how I would have reacted then. I was not a 12-year-old boy who wanted to see boobs. But it rings true to me, and that's what matters. All right, my friends, we're going to get back to the movie, and we're going to keep watching until it reaches 49 minutes and 20 seconds. I'll see you again in about 20 minutes when we're 49 minutes and 20 seconds into Friday the 13th, the final chapter. All right, so the scene where the teens go skinny dipping, I love. And I think in this one scene alone, there is more nudity than has been in the first three movies put together. Because as we've talked about, the Friday the 13th series has this reputation of having lots of nudity, particularly nudity of women. But really, in the first three movies, there's not a lot. In some of them, there's almost none at all. But this movie, Final Chapter, I guess they were going all out, has more nudity and more gore than any of the first three films put together. This is a movie where I think you really start to see like the reputation that this film series would later get, where gory killings, lots of tits and ass. But fun thing about this scene with the skinny dipping scene is that, you know, the girls, some, as we've talked about, some of them were a little nervous about doing this nude scene. So the male actors were like, all right, solidarity, you're going topless, we're going to go bottomless. So you see two of the male actors, naked from the waist down as well. Not full frontal, just from the back. And there are some people who say that this is the first instance of male nudity in the Friday the 13th franchise. Not true. And I say that as a homosexual. I pay attention to these things. In the first movie, you do see about like the top half of Kevin Bacon's butt in the first movie. Trust me, you do. So, but we get more of that here in this scene. And I love that we have, again, not for the first time, but we have a throwback to the fake drowning, you know, that happened in the first movie. A nice little nod to that happening again, little Easter eggs going back to what has come before. It's a great fake out, I think. And again, we're driving in a car, and Gordon the dog starts whimpering as a pair of legs goes by. And if you've been paying attention with these previous three films, there's almost always an instance of like the pet or the animal realizing that something is wrong when Jason is nearby, or like whimpering or trying to run away. And it's like, listen to the pet, damn it, or then you'd survive. But they turn that on its head in this moment, because you think that, you know, Jason's coming for Trish and Tommy as they're trying to fix the car, but it's not Jason. It is Rob, the brother of Sandra. And his introduction, Rob quickly gets along really well with Trish and with Tommy as well. Oh my God! One of the great moments of this franchise is the dance scene. You know what I'm talking about. The scene where Crispin Glover dances to the music, and it reminds me very much of Elizabeth Berkeley's dancing as Nomi Malone in Showgirls. God, I love that movie. Where it looks like she's having a seizure. And in Showgirls, everyone's talking about how great her dancing is. And she just looks like an insane person, like she needs some medication or something. And Crispin Glover is doing that kind of thing. And he said it's actually how he would dance when he went out to clubs. Just this wild, crazy movement. And I love it. I wish that scene went on longer. It could go on much, much longer for my taste. When they were actually filming the scene, Crispin Glover was dancing to the song Back in Black by the band AC/DC. But they obviously could not afford the rights to that song on this film's budget, so they subbed out another song for it. God, great movie. I love you, Crispin Glover. Probably one of my, probably the best male performance in a Friday the 13th movie. I think I feel comfortable saying that, going on the record for sure. Now, the character of Ted, who's really, who, you know, is talking a big game, really, really trying to get laid by someone with breasts in this house, doesn't really care who it seems. He has a teddy bear with him that he uses a gag, and his like pickup line is like, "Want to give teddy bear a kiss?" And it's like, ugh, gross. I also want to take a moment to shout out the costumes in this movie. The costumes in this movie are the most 80s peak 80s costuming. It's just a joy to behold. All right, so we have this skinny dipping scene with Jodie Aronson, okay? And you have to remember that this movie was filmed in wintertime. Yes, we're in California. It still can get very, very cold in California, and it did where they filmed the movie. So she's skinny dipping in this water. Actors said that on the night they filmed this scene, it was like between like 25 and 35 degrees outside, and she is naked. She is not wearing anything. She's in the water. She's on the raft doing the special effect, and they were doing this for hours, like take after take, trying to get things right. And she was so cold, and she asked Jodie Aronson asked Joseph Zito if she could please get out of the water and warm up. And he said, "No, we've got to finish this. We've just got to finish it." So Jodie Aronson gets to a point where she's shivering, her teeth are chattering. She's trying not to cry. Ted White, who is on set as Jason in this scene, saw how much she was suffering, you know, in this freezing water with absolutely no clothes on. And Ted White went over to Joseph Zito and said, "We've got to stop. You've got to let her get out of the water." And Joseph Zito said, no, we've got to finish it. She can't get out." And then Ted White looked at Joseph Zito and said, "Either you let her get out of the water right now, or I'm walking off this movie and not coming back." So Jodie Aronson got to get out of the water, got to go warm up, really thaw out. And then they came back and they finished shooting the scene. So this is one of the instances where Ted White really, really stood up for the young actors, especially the young women in this film. He felt there was a tremendous amount being asked of them for, you know, the pittance that they were getting paid. Good for you, Ted White. And it's very interesting in this movie because you don't see Jason Voorhees in the final chapter from the waist up at all. Until 43 minutes into the film, where you see his head with a hockey mask. And even then, it's only very, very briefly, which I think is an interesting choice, and I think a smart one. And if I had to guess, I would guess that Joseph Zito did that, A, to create suspense, so that when you do see more of Jason in the final, you know, third of the movie, there's real impact there. But I also suspect that a reason for him doing that is not seeing like the face of Jason in the hockey mask very much, because he doesn't want you to identify with Jason. He wants you to identify with these characters, with the Jarvis family, with the teenagers in the house. Those are the characters he wants the audience to care about, so that when they die, it registers. I don't know if that is what he was thinking, but I bet he was. For the first time in a Friday the 13th movie, the weird, awkward, dorky guy gets to have sex. Yay, Crispin Glover. And it's that's really joyous, and he's really adorable, I think. You know, at the sort of post-coitus, when he's like, was I a dead fuck? And you know, she says, "You were wonderful." And he, the way he does that laugh, sort of that laugh of like joy, like can't believe it. Honestly, great acting moment. It's so, so good. And, you know, in all these scenes with the lake, you can tell that the water is cold as fuck. Especially when, you know, the boyfriend of Sarah who's just been killed by Jason on the raft. He starts to take his clothes off. Not all his clothes, though, unfortunately. But he starts wading into the water. Just the way his body moves, you can tell that he's like, oh, God, this is freezing, because the water was. And he is killed with a spear to the dick, which is just brutal. One of the most, I think, brutal kills so far. In this movie and in the franchise. And it's really, that scene is really wonderfully shot. You know, after the spear goes into his groin, you know, there's a really wonderful shot of him being sort of held aloft by this spear to the genitals, and like the light and the fog of the night around him. It's just a really great, great shot. Loves that. And we're back to Rob, who, again, is coming back to Camp Crystal Lake to avenge the death of his sister, Sandra, who died in part two a few days ago, decides to camp in the murdery woods for some reason, and is being stalked by Jason, goes back to his tent and sees that Jason has destroyed his gun and crumpled up his map. And Rob goes, oh, shit. And right then, a thunderstorm begins. All right, my friends. We are going to take another break. You're going to watch until we get to 1 hour, 15 minutes, and 35 seconds. 1 minute, or 1 hour, 15 minutes, 35 seconds, my friends. See you then. All right, and we're back to poor Ted, who is the only character who's not getting lucky tonight, and he was so sure of himself at the beginning of this movie, has decided to start getting high and watch an old reel-to-reel black and white porn movie from like the 20s or 30s on a screen in the house. And this, again, the way this is shot is really effective, because, you know, you have this, you know, movie playing on the screen inside the house. When they go to shots outside of the house, in the window of that room, you can see the flickering, which is just great attention to detail. And it also pairing it with the storm, the thunderstorm that's happening, with like the flashes of lightning and the thunder. Just incredibly, incredibly atmospheric. Just great. Good job, Joseph Cito. I love the conversation that Doug and Sarah have about their sleeping arrangements for the night. It's almost like a Harold Pinter sex comedy, if such a thing existed, like with their dialogue. You know, it's like, I'm going to go back to the room now. Are you tired? No. I'm going to sleep in the would you sleep in the bottom bunk tonight? Yes. Do you want to sleep on the top bunk? No. I did that badly, but like the way they do it is so, so funny and straight faced, and it's just hilarious. I love it. And then we're back to the Jarvis house, where all the lights have gone out, and Mrs. Jarvis comes in, you know, soaking wet from the rain. And it's interesting, and I wonder if, again, this was intentional, because again, with these Easter eggs back to previous movies, for the first time, since the first Friday the 13th, we have a mother character. And we've been reminded of that because the teenagers go past the grave of Mrs. Pamela Voorhees near the beginning of the film. And the scene where the teenagers first arrive and Trish and Tommy and Gordon go outside to say hello, there's a really interesting shot of Joan Freeman as Mrs. Jarvis, where she's looking out the window as her two kids are interacting with these teenagers. And there's a look on her face of, like, almost hatred. Like, she's like, these kids are up to no good. They're going to corrupt my children. And we haven't seen Mrs. Jarvis in a while. Now, you know, she comes in soaking wet. And makes you wonder, like, where has she been? Is she really the killer of all these teenagers? She's not, because she is very quickly killed. She's killed off screen. We don't see her die, which again, it is a style of the Friday the 13th that I really love, where you very often will have, like, several very graphic murder scenes in succession, but then you'll have a murder scene where you do not see the actual death. And I just think that's so smart, because it lets your imagination fill it in and imagine how grisly and awful it must be. And it makes you want, and she's looking for Gordon the dog. Where is Gordon the dog? That's a great question. Crispin Glover also has a really great kill. A little bit funny too, but in a way that works, where he is in the kitchen. He's like, where's the corkscrew? Where's the corkscrew? And then Jason's like, I'll show you where the fucking corkscrew is. And stabs him, his hand to the table with the corkscrew. And then he gets a meat cleaver to the face. Great death. Thank you, Crispin Glover, for your wonderful work in Friday the 13th, the final chapter. Least your character, Jimmy, died happy, knowing that he wasn't a dead fuck, but then he was a dead fuck. And Lawrence Monison as Ted, you know, he is still watching this old porn movie, getting high. And Lawrence Monison decided to get method with it. He was like, what if I am actually high during the scene, like actually high on film? That'll be cool. So before they filmed the scenes, he went to his trailer, smoked a joint, got really, really high, but then realized that he'd made a terrible, terrible mistake, because he is not a person who, like, gets, like, giddy and laughy when he's high. He gets very paranoid. So he goes on set, and he said in subsequent interviews, like, I did not know what was going on. Like, I could not take direction from anybody. I was in a bad state. So one of those instances where, like, you're trying to be truthful to the circumstances, but just pretending is sometimes better. Take note, actor folks, of which I am one. There's an amazing, amazing slow motion kill where the character, the other twin, I apologize for not using the characters' names more often, and I think that is one of the pitfalls of this franchise as it goes on, is that it uses very, very generic names for its characters, as I talked about a little bit earlier, and it sometimes reuses them. So it's hard to remember the names. Like, you remember the faces, you remember the look, but the names sometimes escape you. But when the twin gets thrown out of the window onto the car, and as she lands on the roof of the car windows blow out, and this is all slow motion. It just looks fantastic. And again, you don't really see Jason during this kill. You see him very, very briefly. All right. Then we go to Doug and Sarah in the shower. And again, Peter Barton is just unearthly handsome. It's very strange how good looking he is. And Sarah decides to get out of the shower, and it's like, where are you going? Why are you leaving him there? What are you doing? And of course it's because the script says so, because they've got to be killed separately, of course. But before that happens, Ted finally meets his demise, where the film stops rolling. He goes up to the white movie screen to see what's wrong, and then stabbed with a knife through the back of the head and slides down. And then you just see this trail of his blood on this white flickering movie screen. And I don't know. I feel like there's something poetic about that image, you know, especially since this was intended to be the last Friday the 13th movie. Just that image of just this blood being, you know, being left on a movie screen, like just kind of the essence of what these movies are doing. I don't know. Maybe it's just me, but I really love that moment. And one of the great kills of this movie that Peter Barton gets, Jason breaks the glass, breaks Peter Barton's nose, and then just squishes his head down. And there are these great shots where you, again, how this franchise is haunted by Psycho, these great shots of as his head is being squished, you get these shots of Peter Barton's feet and the blood pooling in the water around him in the shower, almost exactly like the shot, a couple shots in the shower sequence where Janet Leigh is murdered in Psycho. This is, after being teased for a while, I think, unless I'm misremembering, but I think this is actually the very first kill in a shower in this franchise. You know, it's been teased a couple times in previous movies, but this is the first time someone's actually killed in the shower, and it's a guy, which I really love, you know, upending the expectation of that. Like, you're expecting it to be Sarah who's killed in the shower, but no, it is Doug who's killed in the shower. But then Sarah is killed with an axe to her chest as she's wearing her towel. Again, another amazing streak of special effects makeup work by Tom Savini. So glad he returned for this movie. You know, the special effects in part two and part three are good, but there's nothing like Tom Savini for gore. There just isn't. Okay, so now it's just Trish, Tommy, and Rob left, plus Gordon the dog. All the teenagers are now killed. So once the three Trish and Rob figure out what's going up, they go down to the basement of the murder house. That always ends well, going into the dark basement in a horror movie, sure. And then a moment happens that is really awesome, but also kind of inexplicable. Gordon the dog decides to jump, just fucking yeet himself out the window, jumps through the window, breaking the glass, and is never seen again in this film, which I kind of love that, like, again, we've talked about how, like, the pets in these movies know what's up, that Gordon the dog is just like, no, fuck this. Y'all are crazy for staying in this house and going into the basement with this killer. I'm out of here. I'm gone. And Gordon is never seen again. I'm sure he got adopted by some nice folks down the line. And interesting thing that is foreshadowing for later, we go back to the Jarvis house and Tommy finds Rob's stash of articles about the Camp Crystal Lake murders and about Jason Voorhees both as a boy and as the adult killer he now is. That's going to come back in a little bit. And then we finally, Rob in the basement is attacked by Jason Voorhees and killed. And they had planned to do a whole, Savini had planned to do a whole effect with this kill, but in the end, they decided not to show it. It happens in the dark, which I think is very effective. And again, you're not seeing a lot of Jason's face. But during this scene, Rob is saying, like, he's killing me, he's killing me. And this was actually something that director Joseph Sito wanted in the film. It was inspired by an article he read about the real-life murder of Kitty Genovese, who was murdered actually on Friday, March 13th, 1964. She was stabbed to death, and their newspaper reports at the time reported that up to 38 other people in the apartment building heard her screaming, he's stabbing me, he's killing me, oh my God, he's killing me. And Joseph Sito was really haunted by that. And so he wanted this moment with Rob, again, who has come back to avenge the death of his sister is now being killed by Jason. He really wanted it to be this big emotional moment where, you know, that kicks the audience in the stomach of like the loss of this human life. Except it doesn't work. It's quite funny, actually. And Joseph Zito has said many times that he thinks that the idea did not go as well as he expected, that, you know, the character of Rob, it just made him seem weaker, and, you know, those lines coming from a man especially from the actor who played Rob, like, just does not work. And he said that during the scene when the movie was first released, people would always laugh hysterically, which is a shame. But yeah, it was a really good idea, and I think that could have worked, but doesn't quite work the way they wanted to. And then Trish leaves the basement. And now, refill your popcorn, because we're going to watch till the very end of this movie, and then we're going to come back. So enjoy the really fantastic and very, very action-packed conclusion to Friday the 13th, the final chapter. Okay, so right where we left off, Rob is killed by Jason. Trish runs up the basement stairs. She's out of the basement. And then she goes back into the basement. It's like, what are you doing? And then when eventually she finally decides, oh, I should probably get out of this house, which, yes, that's a good idea. She finds various characters placed at the windows and doorways by Jason to scare her and prevent her from coming out. One of the characters, it's kind of unclear which one, you don't really see the face, but one of the male victims has been almost like crucified in a doorway, has had both his hands with big nails or spikes hammered through them, you know, arms outstretched in a crucifixion pose. And it's really, really brutal when Jason then exits and just pulls that body down, and you see the hands just slide through those spikes or nails. Ooh, grisly. Great effect by Tom Savini. This is really the Broken Window movie. Like, you might have noticed, I've talked about it a lot already, and there's even more of it in just the final 15 minutes of, like, there's so many characters jumping through windows or being thrown through windows or dogs jumping through windows. They really, really use that a lot. I don't know why, but it's kind of cool. And I love there's the big Jason scare with Tommy, played by Corey Feldman, which has become kind of a famous moment in the lore of the franchise. So, as we have established, Ted White, who played Jason, did not like Corey Feldman at all. And there's this scene where, you know, again, kind of echoing how the scares worked in several movies before it, where Tommy is in front of a window and Jason is going to jump through the window and grab him. And Ted White decided this was finally his opportunity to get back at Corey Feldman. And so they, you know, had rehearsed the scene with Ted White and Corey Feldman, and Joseph Zito said, like this is how long it's going to be, and then Jason's going to come and grab you. Okay, so they roll the cameras, and the time that Corey Feldman had been told for when Jason was going to grab him passed, a few seconds passed. So Corey Feldman was like, oh, I guess something went wrong with the effect. And then Ted White grabbed him, scared the shit out of him, waited just a few seconds longer so that Corey Feldman would be off guard when Ted White grabbed him. And Corey Feldman said that, like, he was legitimately terrified when they shot that. Like, Ted White really got him. You know, he said he was hyperventilating, he was shaking. They finished filming the scene, everyone ran over to him. We're like, Corey, you're okay? He was like, no, I'm not okay. He said it took him a while to recover from that, but you can really see that in the scene, that he is legitimately terrified. It's great. I love when Trish and Tommy try and take refuge in Tommy's room, and they're moving a bookcase to cover the door so Jason can't get in. But then they don't move the bookcase all the way. They leave, you know, this whole big chunk of door that is not protected, which of course Jason uses an axe to break through. That's funny. And great moment where Trish breaks a TV over Jason's head. This whole sequence, the final 15 minutes of this movie, I think is the best final sequence of a Friday the 13th movie so far. It is so action-packed, and it is a real battle. The character of Trish is not just screaming and running away. She is fighting him. She is a badass in this sequence. She is fighting for her life and for Tommy's life. It's so, so good. And she is so great in this movie, I have to say. Kimberly Beck as Trish. Really fantastic performance. Definitely, one of the great, great final girls of this series. I do love, again, when Trish jumps out of the window, because, you know, it's the thing to do in this movie, lands on the ground below. First of all, like, there's no way that you could fall from that height and not seriously injure yourself. But she falls, she's lying on the ground, appears to be dead. Jason looks through the window and sees her and then goes away. And it's so typical of 80s slashers. Because, of course, when she falls on the ground, is lying there in the pouring rain, of course she's fallen in a way that her dress has ridden up and you can see her panties because it's Friday the 13th. And then we have Tommy, who again, remember, found the newspaper articles about Jason Voorhees earlier, including Child Jason. So Tommy's using his noggin. He is putting makeup on his face under his eyes, and he's cutting off all his hair to look like how the Child Jason looked. And it's a great payoff for that first scene when you see Tommy and his mom says, "You need to get a haircut." Tommy's getting a haircut. They didn't actually cut Corey Feldman's hair. He wore a bald cap. It was makeup by Tom Savini. Really, really well done. And again, this battle to the death with Jason, Trish has had it. I love the moment where she slices through Jason's hand with a machete, like almost slices his hand in half. And there's a moment where he just kind of looks at it as this blood is just sort of seeping, like, ah, interesting. And Trish has a great line. She says, "You son of a bitch, I'm going to give you something to remember us by," which is absolutely savage and great. And I love her. And she whacks off Jason's hockey mask. We see Jason's face. And for whatever reason, Jason Voorhees looks like he's aged a lot in the past couple days. His face is much more wrinkly than it has been in part two and part three. But then we have the great, great kill of Jason, where he's hit with the machete through the eye, and then the camera holds on him as his head just slides down the machete on the floor. And Tom Savini has said that, you know, as with all the Friday the 13th films, a lot of the kills had to be shortened because of the MPAA requesting cuts to make an R rating. But Tom Savini said that because a lot of the other kills were cut down and that visually happened very quickly, it made it even more effective at the end with Jason's death, which, like, you really, really linger on. And I think he's right. It's amazingly effective. But Jason, His hands are still twitching, and then Corey Feldman takes the machete and just starts hacking at him mercifully, saying, "Die! Die! Die!" as Trish looks on in horror. And when Corey Feldman filmed this scene, he was actually very, very sick. He had a 101 degree fever at this point. And he said in interviews that because he was so sick and was just trying to be present and give the energy, like, in that scene as he's, you know, killing Jason, like, the intensity in his eyes, like, he's giving everything he has got. And what he's doing is actually hitting the machete against a couple of sandbags, perhaps imagining getting back at Ted White for scaring him a little bit earlier in the movie. Great, great scene. And then we're in a hospital, where Trish has survived, and she asks to see Tommy one more time. Tommy comes to her, gives her a hug, and she was actually instructed when they did the hug to put her hand at the base of his neck so it would hide the skull cap makeup, which she did very well. And then Tommy looks at the camera and gives this look of intense, disturbed evil. And that's the end. And the intention of that, per the screenwriter and director and producers, was that the horror of Jason, the horror of this madness and murder, could potentially be passed on to little Tommy Jarvis, who's 12 years old now, but perhaps, should there be another movie, might grow to become the next Jason Voorhees-esque serial killer. That Jason was dead in this movie, but maybe Tommy Jarvis is going to go on a rampage in a couple years. Who knows? We'll have to see. There was an alternate ending filmed for this movie that has been released. If you see this film on DVD or Blu-ray, it is most often included as a special feature. The alternate ending was that there was going to be another dream sequence, because they've used those in most of the movies so far, where Trish goes back to the house in the daytime and notices that there's water trickling down from upstairs. She goes upstairs and finds the dead body of her mother, Mrs. Jarvis, in the bathtub, you know, in this bloody water, and she's crying and sobbing and is holding her mother's dead body, and then Mrs. Jarvis's eyes open, and her eyes are just pure white with no irises, and then Jason comes in, raises his machete, and then she wakes up from the nightmare. Joseph Seeder, the director, said that they chose to cut that from the film pretty quickly. They felt it was just too much, and they wanted to leave Jason definitively dead and focus on that really disturbing final shot of Tommy Jarvis, played by Corey Feldman. So I think Friday the 13th, the final chapter, is kind of the ubiquitous Friday the 13th movie for me. Like, if someone asked me, like, hey, I want to see a movie that is basically like a good example of a Friday the 13th movie, this movie is the one I would show them. I personally love the first movie the most, but I do think that Friday the 13th, the final chapter, is the movie where this franchise finally crystallizes and solidifies into what it is known for, into what it would be from now on. It's just great. I love the character development in this film. I think the acting is great. The cast is great. If anything, I think the one thing about Friday the 13th, the final chapter, that I mourn a little bit is that in this movie, and really in all the movies subsequently, Jason Voorhees becomes more like Michael Myers, in that there's just the soulless kill, like mechanical killing machine. Whereas, as I've talked about, I think in part two and part three, there really is that human aspect behind what Jason Voorhees is doing, avenging the death of his mother. the final chapter of the fourth movie is really kind of abandons that completely. And, you know, I think doesn't focus on Jason in order to focus more on the characters who are going to die and giving them humanity, which I think is great and important. But I do, you know, this is the movie where Jason kind of just becomes a killing machine, albeit still a human killing machine, which will not be true for much, much longer. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Going back to our bad reviews again. Again, Roger Ebert and Gene Siskel had some choice words for this film. They called it an immoral and reprehensible piece of trash. Did not like it without, and no surprise there. But Friday 13th, the final chapter, has only grown in reputation over the years, and is now justifiably so regarded as one of the best, if not the best, film in this franchise. All right, my friends, I will see you all next week, where we will get to the next Friday the 13th film. We're now halfway through this series, my friends. We are 4 Friday the 13th down. 4 more to go, and I look forward to the journey, and I hope you are too. I am your host, Josh Hitchens. I wish you all pleasant dreams.